Well, good morning to each of you here this frigid morning at Terra Shores, and good morning to those of you in Berlin worshiping at River Shores also this morning. Mankind has, all through its history, I suppose, been confused, apart from God and His revelation, of who we are and what we are all about. And one of the common confusions has to do with whether we are just animals or more than animals. I thought you'd enjoy seeing this little video clip that we have here. We'll go ahead and play, reminding us of that. That's not the clip, that's the picture. I can tell you what the picture is of, though. I may as well explain that as long as you watch this. Go ahead. If you hadn't seen it before, Just for Laughs, it was like a candid camera type of show a few years ago produced in Canada. But the idea that mankind is like the animals, that picture that was up here actually is a picture from the London Zoo that had a Homo sapiens exhibit a few years ago. And they did that with volunteers. They had a number of volunteers and they had to choose. In history, there have been a number of human zoo exhibits, but not all of them with volunteers. Sometimes they have been forced. In fact, various cultures have been brought in at times to the shame of humanity and put on an exhibit like that on a forced display. When mankind sees us itself as just another animal, we miss completely God's perspective in all of this. Sure, there are similarities physiologically. Sure, God has created animals to live in this world, and He has created humans to live in this world. Physiologically, there are similarities, but God took a step further when He created mankind, when He created male and female, Adam and Eve. He created man with an eternal soul, the ability to relate to Him. In fact, not only the ability to relate to God, but mankind has built within him a need for God. That's why every race, every civilization has throughout history had a search after God in some form or another. It is man's inbuilt need for God, seeking God, and that vast difference sets mankind apart. We were created to have a relationship with our Maker and to know Him forever. And our value lies not in ourselves because we have earned something. It lies in the fact of who God calls us to be. Then this morning, I want to invite you, we're taking a break from the Gospel of John, invite you to look with me in Psalm 139, this familiar psalm written by David, a psalm that reminds us, specifically the scriptures we're going to look at this morning, about three areas that demonstrate our value to God. The first part of the chapter reminds us that there is nowhere we can go to escape God. Reminds us that God knows everything about us completely. But then in the middle of the chapter, beginning there at verse 13, he goes on and speaks about three different areas demonstrating our value to God. And the first is that God created us. Beginning there in verse 13, we read these words, "For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb." The word "you" is emphatic here. As David wrote these words, he repeatedly used the word "you," not only in this verse, but in the following verses. "You did this, you did this," and he's talking to God. David is emphasizing that you are our source of life. As Genesis 1:1 tells us the beginning of the material universe, so Psalm 139, verse 13, tells us our beginning, my beginning, your beginning. "For you created my inmost being." The word "inmost being" actually is the word "kidneys." You created my kidneys. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Sure, he created our kidneys and everything else inside of us. But in the ancient world, the idea of the kidney was that it was one of the innermost organs. It was the seat of our emotions and our affections, and that God even created that. He created not only what you see, but what you don't see. He created not only the tangible part of us, but that intangible part of us. What is it that gives us this who we are, this personhood, this self-consciousness that I am an individual and a person? It is God. And David makes it very clear here, the emphasis is upon God as the creator. Not only are we God's work, we are God's skilled work. Verse 13 goes on, "You knit me together in my mother's womb." The word "knit," or sometimes it's translated "weave," implies a careful plan. Some of you have, ladies in particular, often have been involved in handicraft type of things, weaving or knitting, crocheting, those type of things. And you know that when you do that, there's a plan to it. That's the picture here, that God put us together with a plan. And he goes on and says, "I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made." When you stop to think about mankind in all of the systems in the human body, life in and of itself, but then mankind in particular, David said, "All I can do is give worship and praise." And he uses a couple of words there, interesting words, "fearfully and wonderfully." What David is saying is, when I stop to look at myself, and you look at your hands, you look at the makeup of your body, and to wonder how that could be put together, David says, it causes me respect and awe. The word "fearfully" has the idea of a sense of awe and fear of one who could do such things. The word "wonderfully" has the idea of being distinct, set apart. We see the inanimate world around us, and that's pretty amazing as we go into the smaller and smaller reaches of the molecule or atoms. We find out that most of what we think of as the material universe is actually vast space. It has to do with electromagnetic forces that cause our hand to be able to hit against wood rather than to go through wood. And it's amazing to learn the intricacies of that, and there's far more that we don't know that we're continuing to learn as information explodes. But David, for what he knew in his day, looked at it and he said, "This is amazing. It is wonderful. It creates a sense of awe in me." In the 1800s, British preacher Charles Spurgeon said, "Who can gaze even upon a model of our anatomy without wonder and awe? Who could dissect a portion of the human frame without marveling at its delicacy and trembling at its frailty?" The truthfulness of what David said then applies to this very day. And it was interesting for me to find out, and I don't know what the figures are on this at all, but it was interesting for me to find out that as David, our son, has studied the last few years at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, to find out through him how many of his professors, how many of the doctors there are theists, and actually quite a number of them solid Bible-believing Christians. That was amazing, because we often think of science as the area of skepticism, but so many of them are solid Christians, or at least theists, understanding that there is a God who put this all together. The chances are just infinitely small that something like this could happen by chance. And David is looking at this. David, 3,000 years ago, wrote this Psalm 139, sees the same thing that we see today. Now, verse 15 goes on and says, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth." Not only are we God's skillful work, but we are God's purposeful work. God saw us every step along the way, and there was nothing that was hidden from him. The word frame is literally "my bone was not hidden from you." Our bodies were put together in the secret place of the depths of the earth. It's hard to know exactly what David is referring to. Some think that he may have been referring to the fact that mankind is made from dust. That he's using a picture that reminds us that Adam came from dust. The womb for Adam was the ground, and that the earth is where we were taken from. That might be the case. We don't know, but the clear message here is that God purposed it, and he had his eye upon us when he created each person, each one in mankind. The importance of this is that it reminds us we were created for his special purposes. Alexander Tassiaris, a mathematician and visual artist, came up with some special visualization software, and just a couple of years ago in 2010, he presented that. It was a software that allowed him to explore the unseen human body and the development of the fetus from conception to birth. And you can actually watch this online. It is fascinating to watch, and we're not going to take time to show it here. It's a little bit long to show this morning. But as he was presenting this at a conference, a 2010 lecture to medical personnel, he highlighted the miracle of life, and he never spoke about his faith or lack of faith. I don't know where he is, this visualization artist and mathematician. I don't know where he is in his faith. But he noted that at 44 days, the fetus has become something you can recognize. At 9 weeks, it's really like a kind of little human being. At 28 days, the baby's heart resembles a magnificent origami, developing at a rate of 1 million cells per second. At 32 days, the arms and hands are developing, and within 5 weeks, you can start to see the heart's early atrium and ventricles. A week later, the baby's heart is actually becoming mature. At 52 days, that's just over 7 weeks, the retina, the nose, and the fingers are developing. And by the time the fetus is full term, by the time that baby is full term, it has 60,000 miles of vessels inside its body, and only 1 mile of vessels are visible. The other 59,999 miles of vessels are quietly working to bring nutrients and dispose of waste. And Tassiaris summarizes his talk by saying this. He says, "The complexity of these facts about human development, the mathematic models of how these indeed are done, are beyond human comprehension." He said, "Even though I'm a mathematician, I look at this with marvel. How do these instruction sets not make mistakes as they build what is us? It's a mystery. It's magic. It's divinity. It's beyond any comprehension of any existing mathematics today." Now, this we often think of ourselves as being so advanced. This was spoken just a couple of years ago by this mathematician who came up with this. Mankind was made by God, created skillfully with a purpose. You are valuable to God. Every person in this world is valuable to God. And it's important that we never lose that, never miss that. That is the theme of what David is writing about here. And a few years ago, R.C. Sproul, who is an author and lecturer, shared the story of a college student that he once taught who had cerebral palsy. He said, "You know what he looks like. He had the spastic movements, the garbled speech. But as often the case, the student was very bright and capable." And Sproul wrote, he said, "One day he came to me vexed with a problem, and he asked me to pray for him. So in the course of the prayer, I said something routine. I prayed words something like this. Oh God, please help this man as he wrestles with this problem. When I opened my eyes, the student was quietly weeping. And I asked him what was wrong, and he stammered his reply. He said, 'In your prayer, you called me a man. No one has ever called me a man before.'" We are made in the image of God. And defects or not, blowing it or not, bad choices or not, falling short or not, we're valuable to God. And the importance of understanding that It's because he created us, the bottom line. Parents, remember, as you're, and some of you are right in this stage right now, as your kids were small and they started doing crafts, preschool even, they start coloring, they start cutting out shapes, they start making things. You remember as they brought you things that they made, what did you do with those things that they made? Crumple them up and throw them in the wastebasket? Of course not. You took those things and you put them on the refrigerator. Or you put them on your desk. I still have things in my office. The writing is so faded because of the years that have gone by, made by our kids. Why? Because it's valuable, because who made it? Well, that is exactly the truth of what David is writing here. You are valuable because God made you. Secondly, you're valuable because God cares for you. In verse 16, he goes on, and notes, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Now, all the days reminds us that God doesn't miss a single day. You know, every day we get up and we're caught off guard. We think we know what's coming, but we really don't. We don't know what each day holds, but God does. He knows the day before it even begins. All that were ordained for me. The word ordained is a word that, an Old Testament word that means to fashion or form. The picture is of a potter forming a pot. So the idea here is that God fashioned our days. Now that's amazing. We don't live by chance. God knows whether we will choose to obey or disobey. God knows whether we will follow him or turn from him. Whether we will choose righteousness or sin, love or hatred. He knows all of those things. All of this does not catch him by surprise. These things were written in your book, all of our days written in your book, settled and certain before one of them came to be. See what that's saying? Now, we may not like that, but it's true. In the mind of God, our course was charted before our journey ever began. You say, well, that's determinism. Yes, it is determinism, and we can't escape it because God knows all things, and he saw all of those days before one of them came to be. But it doesn't abrogate, it doesn't take away my choice. In the midst of that, God has still chosen to tell me, or called me to choose him, to choose righteousness, to choose love, and that choice I still have, and so do you. But we don't get out of his will. We don't get out of his wisdom or out of his knowledge. All of our days were ordained before one of them came to be. His sovereignty. He cares for us. His omniscience. Verse 17. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. The word precious is the idea of valuing and prizing something. Now, why would David say that? Your thoughts toward me are precious. Why? Because if God knows everything about me and nothing catches him by surprise, his thoughts toward me, calling me to follow him, shows a tremendous amount of care. When you think about someone constantly, it shows you care for them. It shows your concern for them. Now multiply that and think of it in terms of an infinite God who thinks about you and knows every aspect of your life. It shows an infinite care for you. If my thinking repeatedly about someone shows that I care for them, what does an infinite God's constant thoughts toward me say about me in his attitude toward me? That he cares for me tremendously. An everlasting love. We sang about that this morning. And that's exactly what Scripture says, that his love is from everlasting to everlasting upon those who fear him. The importance of understanding that his thoughts toward us are precious. Think with me for a moment, those of you who are married, about the days that you first met your spouse-to-be. And you fell in love, or you grew into love, or however you came to desire that spouse that you married. Remember how you used to think about them so often you couldn't get them out of your minds during those days? And probably it crossed your mind also to wonder, I wonder if they're thinking about me. And if you would get a note from them, or you would get a letter from them, or an email from them, depending how old you are, you would be ecstatic because you realized that they were thinking about you. And if they were thinking about you, obviously they cared for you. David says, God knows everything about me. His thoughts toward me are vast. How vast is the sum of them? Therefore, they are precious to me. Because why? Because they remind me that he cares for me, that he loves me. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. God's thoughts toward us can't be numbered. His purposes for us, his knowledge of us is so thorough that it can't be quantified. What that says is he cares for you tremendously. Now, verse 18 continues with these words, "When I awake, I am still with you." What he's referring to there, we're not certain. He could be talking about the fact that even when I'm dreaming, I'm asleep, God is with me. When I wake up, you're still with me. Some have said it may be the sleep of death. He's saying here that we die and then we are resurrected. I am still with you. Death does not separate us from him. It may be talking about the implication that just to think about these heady thoughts, these lofty thoughts of who God is and how vast is his knowledge, how wise he is, and how great is his love, just to think about all those things kind of raises us out of reality. But when we come back to reality, the final run of it is he's still with us. We cannot escape him. He is with us. Now, there are times that you and I will feel closer to God than other times. Those are our emotions. There are times where we'll feel very spiritual and very close to him. There are times that we'll feel very distant from him. But the reality of it is that we cannot escape him. He is with us in every time. Writer Kenneth Wilson tells of growing up in Pittsburgh in a house he said that we lived in the side of one of Pittsburgh's hills. It was three stories high in the front and four in the back. He said the bottom layer was a cellar, and the top was what we called, the third floor was really a finished attic. Now, he said up there in that attic area, there were two bedrooms, a hallway, a mysterious storage room for trunks that always smelled like mothballs in history, and it was up there that our family slept. Now, the second floor we usually rented out to a tenant to help pay the rent. But Kenneth remembers being the youngest. He said, I had to go to bed first, and I had to brave that floor up on top of dark bedrooms first. And he said, I'd get sent up to bed, and it felt like a long way up those steps because there was no electricity above the second floor. A gas light had to be turned on and then turned off once I was settled into bed. And my father would come up, and I'd go to that bedroom. It would seem to be at the end of the earth, remote from human habitation, close to unexplained noises and dark secrets. And at my urging, my father would try to stop the windows from rattling. I mean, he would wedge wooden matchsticks into the crack, but they always rattled in spite of that. Sometimes he'd read me a story, but inevitably the time would come when he would turn out the light and shut the door, and I'd hear his steps on the stairs growing fainter and fainter and fainter, and then everything would be quiet except for the rattling windows and my cowering imagination. Once, he said, I remember my father saying, would you rather that I leave the light on and go downstairs or turn the light out and stay with you for a while? And what I chose, without doubt, was his presence with the darkness over his absence with the light. And then Kenneth Wilson goes on to say, is that not what we really want most when we pray? The assurance that someone is there, that someone hears us? Well, absolutely it is. If we can have that absolute certainty that God is with us right now, in my deepest trials, in my greatest joys, that he is there and he is involved and nothing escapes his notice, what greater sense of assurance than that? To know that he is there. I think we often forget that because God is invisible to our physical eyes. But as a parent, if you've ever worried about your grown children or as they get into their teen years, they're out, or if you've ever worried about them, you know what a relief it is when they call home and say, hey, I'm doing fine, I'm here, or whatever, I'm doing this or that. Just to know they're there and they're fine. It's that same thing with God. If we can have that sense of assurance, and he would give us that, and David says, when I awake, I am still with you. God cares for us. That means he values us. There's one final issue he deals with here, briefly, is that he cleanses us. This beautiful Psalm 139 at verse 19 takes, you might think of, as a negative turn. David begins to look at others. When he looks at God, he is overwhelmed and he praises God. But now he begins to look at the world around him. And in verse 19, he says, "If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men." David is thinking about those who are wicked around him, who are violent. And the thoughts of the reality of this world made him wish that God would get rid of all of those who are wicked. Now, when he says the wicked, David is not talking about those who are trying to do well and just fall short. He is talking about those who are in rebellion against God, would shake their fist before God and say, "I'll do what I want." He goes on to describe that in verse 20. "They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries, they misuse your name." In other words, they use God's name in vain. They curse. Verse 21, "Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies." Wow. You know, when we read through Psalm 139, more often than not, we leave out verses 19 through 22. It sounds pretty negative, doesn't it? David sounds like he has a great deal of hatred for those who love wickedness. Now, this passage doesn't tell us whether David's attitude is right or not. I think David's attitude of hatred toward wickedness is right. Whether we should hate those who are wicked or not, we could debate that. But what David is seeing here is a vast difference between a God who loves and mankind, much of mankind, who revile God. And David's desire is to get rid of that. Now, probably you have felt that at times in the recent shooting at the school in Newtown, Connecticut. Perhaps you felt, "Why this wickedness, O God? Who are these lunatics running around? Get rid of them, Lord. Change our world. Straighten it out." Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner, regarding David's prayer here, says, "For all of its vehemence, the hatred in this passage is not quite spite, but it is zeal for God. What David hates is that anyone would reject this God who loves us, who made us, who cares for us, and knows us intimately. And David hates that anyone would reject him." So he responds in this way. But how do we know that David's hatred is not just self-righteousness, saying, "Get rid of all of them, I'm righteous"? And that's the way often we can be. Look at the choices that our culture makes. Lord, get rid of our culture. And we can pridefully stand back in our self-righteousness. But that wasn't what David was saying. Look at how he closes this chapter. Verse 23. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts." David is not so self-deceived to think that he has it all together and he is righteous. David's hatred of evil comes not from pride, but from his commitment to God. So it doesn't lead him to self-righteousness. It leads him to humility and an honest prayer before God. "Oh God, show me myself. Search me and know me. Test me. Put me to the test." In fact, the word he uses here has the idea of examine, scrutinize me. David wants God to look at him closely because only God can accurately see his innermost motives. You know, one of the deceptive things about us as human beings is that we not only are good at deceiving others, we can deceive ourselves. At the very point that we are trying to be altruistic, we can secretly start to become proud that we're being so altruistic. At the very point that we are humble before God, we begin to look at ourselves and think, "Boy, I'm pretty humble." We're so easily deceived ourselves. And David recognized the sinfulness of his heart. And he said, "Lord God, search me and know me. And know my anxious thoughts." Interesting word that he uses there. Anxious thoughts are the idea of those thoughts that disquiet me, that put me in turmoil. Someone has said you can learn a lot about a man by understanding what it is that he worries about. What do you worry about? The worries that you have to do with selfishness, have to do with unbelief. David looked at that and he said, "Lord, test me and know what I worry about. Know my anxious thoughts." And the truth is, we need God to search us. I read an interesting survey that was done here. If you're like most people, you're way above average. In fact, psychologists call this state illusory superiority. It simply means we tend to inflate our positive qualities and abilities, especially in comparison to other people. Some of the research studies that have revealed this tendency to overrate ourselves have really shown some interesting results. Researchers asked a million high school students how well they got along with their peers, and none of the students, out of a million, none of them rated themselves below average. As a matter of fact, 60% of the students believed they were in the top 10%. 60% believed they were in the top 10%. 25% rated themselves in the top 1%. You'd think college professors might have more self-insight, but they were just as biased in their ability. College professors, 2% rated themselves below average, 10% rated themselves average, and 63% rated themselves above average, while 25% rated themselves as truly exceptional. Now, these statistics are impossible, but that's how they viewed themselves. Psychologist who wrote about this said it is the great contradiction. The average person believes that he is a better person than the average person. We are self-deceived, and David understood that. So he said, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me, know my thoughts." Note verse 24, "See if there is any offensive way in me." Offensive way. Literally, it is way of pain. See if there is a way of pain. In other words, is my lifestyle and what I'm doing and what I'm choosing and how I'm viewing life, is it that which leads to pain for myself or others? Well, obviously, anything that is sin that takes us away from God leads to pain. And David says, "Lord, see if there is any way of pain in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." The way that lasts forever. Well, what he's showing here is the way to destruction, the way of pain, or the way to life, the way everlasting. And David said, "I need you to show me myself and lead me in the everlasting way." What David's prayer here is really a prayer for redemption. Lord, save me. Save me from my wicked heart. Just this last fall, the New York Yankees were swept out of the playoffs in a four-game series against the Detroit Tigers. Some of you baseball fans may have watched that. The Detroit Tigers played well. The Yankees played horrible. They mustered only 6 runs and a pathetic batting average of 158 during that four-game series. Almost every Yankee did poorly at the plate. Most of the blame fell to their alleged star hitter, Alex Rodriguez. And right in the midst of Rodriguez's hitting slump, a rabid Yankee fan held up a sign with the bold letters that read, "A-Rod," they called him A-Rod, "A-Rod, redeem thyself." Now, the ever-insightful folks at Mockingbird blog pointed out that's a pretty accurate picture of our spiritual plight. One author went on and said, "How do you think A-Rod felt if he saw that, if he looked up and he saw that sign, 'A-Rod, redeem thyself'?" Looking up in the stands, he said, "I know how I'd feel. I'd want to jump over the wall, clamber up to that fan's row, and scream in his face, 'Look, I'm trying to get hits. Don't you think I'd be playing better if it was up to me? Don't you think I'd redeem myself if I could?'" That's the heart of the gospel. Of course we'd redeem ourselves if we could, but we can't. And David recognized that. He looked at this world and he said, "Lord, away with the wickedness." And then he looked at his own heart and said, "Lord, search me too. And see if there's a wicked way in me, an offensive way. And Lord, lead me in the everlasting way." David understood that we are valuable to God, so valuable because he created us, because he cares for us, and because if we want him to, he cleanses us and leads us in the everlasting way. Our culture forgets that value of mankind because God made us and he cares for us and he cleanses us. University professor Chris Gabbard used to believe that some human being should be allowed or even encouraged to die. In his own words, Chris Gabbard said he grew up prizing intellectual aptitude and detesting poor mental functioning. So this led Gabbard to adopt the ethics of the contemporary philosopher Peter Singer. Peter Singer argues that society has a right to exclude people who are not really persons. And Singer and Gabbard believe that, for instance, severely disabled people should either be killed or allowed to die. But that changed when Gabbard's own son was born. During childbirth, his son experienced permanent brain damage, and today Gabbard's son is a blind quadriplegic with cerebral palsy. And Gabbard writes movingly about the first time he saw his newborn son in the intensive care unit. And he said, after his birth, I was deeply ambivalent, having been persuaded by Peter Singer and his advocacy of infanticide. But there was my son, either asleep or unconscious, on a ventilator, motionless under a heat lamp, tubes and wires everywhere, monitors alongside his steel and transparent plastic crib. But Gabbard goes on and says, what stirred me most was the way he resembled me. Nothing prepared me for this shock of recognition. For he was the boy in my own baby pictures, the image of me when I was an infant. And today, Gabbard is an advocate for the inherent dignity of severely disabled human beings. He pointed to a 2010 Gallup poll that says nearly half of Americans, 46%, support assisted suicide. And Gabbard went on to say about this, many such well-meaning people would like to end my son's suffering, but they do not stop to consider whether he's actually suffering. At times he's uncomfortable, yes, but the only real pain here seems to be the pain of those who cannot bear the thought that people like my son exist. The story of Dr. Gabbard's change of heart serves as a reminder of the inherent dignity of every human being made in the image of God. C.S. Lewis, British author in the 1900s, reminds us of this when he says, remember that the dullest and most uninteresting people that you may talk to one day will be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else they will be a horror and corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations, either the way of pain that leads to destruction or the way everlasting that leads to life. And it is the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all of our dealings with one another, all friendship, all loves, all play, all politics. C.S. Lewis concluded this by saying, there are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. You have talked to one created in the image of God who will live forever, either with him or apart from him. There are no mere mortals. Let's pray together.